Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Kentucky has a reading problem, and it's costing money, major bucks. It's the focus of Chapter 1, In Between the Lines, Why Kentucky's Kids Can't Read and Who's to Blame, a five-chapter series by Courier-Journal investigative reporter Mandy McLaren. She's on the line from Louisville. Hi, Mandy.
Hi.
What prompted you to analyze and write about illiteracy in Kentucky?
That's a great question. It goes back a couple of years, but it really started at the beginning of this year when we were heading into the legislative session, and there was a bill on the table to give control to school boards to determine school curriculum, which had traditionally been a responsibility of Kentucky's unique site-based decision councils. And from my previous just paying attention to what's going on across the country with curriculum and literacy, I knew that that could be a big deal because there have been problems reported elsewhere with schools approaching literacy in a way that is not backed up by science. So that began me looking into this issue, and I thought it was just going to be a two-week story. It's taken me many months to complete, but that's how that began.
That's what can happen when you start peeling the layers of the onion, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Well, Kentucky's long had this persistent illiteracy problem. What's new here is that you have calculated the actual cost of this. And what have you learned?
Sure. I think even the cost that I have is undercounting. So I know from the efforts that I studied in particular, Kentucky has poured at least $345 million into literacy over the past two decades. That doesn't count for the millions more spent by individual school districts and just other literacy initiatives that I didn't put a sharp eye on for this project. So clearly it's a lot of money. And when you think about how much more it could be that we're spending, and then you look at the results that we've been getting, even before the pandemic, more than 150,000 of the state's public school students did not meet Kentucky's own standard for reading proficiency. And some kids can barely read. In middle school, one in three students before the pandemic failed the state reading test.
Has your investigation revealed why we have such a dismal literacy rate?
Yes. And so it goes to the heart of the matter, which is teaching and how kids are being taught to read. And I think in the past, especially in a state like Kentucky, poor performance gets blamed on poverty. It gets blamed on what's going on at home. And what I wanted to really highlight in this series is that school's fundamental obligation is to educate children, right? And when we think about that, number one priority is teaching them to read. So that is something that schools, despite the amount of poverty in the state, do have control over. And what I found is that in schools across the state, teachers have been using a method that is not backed up by brain science. And the important thing to know here is that unlike speech, which is a natural thing for us humans, reading is not. It is something that needs to be turned on in our brains, and decades of research show exactly how to do that. Unfortunately, because of some of the trends in literacy instruction over the past two decades, that approach, the one that turns the reading center on in your brain, hasn't been used. Instead, kids have been taught habits of poor readers.
Tell us what you learned when you talked with former State Education Commissioner Stephen Pruitt.
Sure. When I talked to Dr. Pruitt, he was very concerned about what this means for the future of Kentucky. I don't know the figure off the top of my head, but a very large portion of the jobs in the state are going to be taken over by automation in the next decade or so. And that means that the jobs that are left are going to require strong literacy skills and strong critical thinking skills. And clearly, if we keep at the rate we are right now, and things have gotten worse because of the pandemic, now the majority of kids are not proficient in reading. Honestly, it puts us on the path to disaster for the state.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, as you dug into this, you found more and more. And now there are five chapters in this series. What are the focuses of the four other chapters?
Sure. Chapter two gets into why this is happening, why teachers aren't teaching reading the correct way. And so it takes a look at what's happening in our teacher training programs. Chapter 3 looks at a specific literacy grant program that's been around for a couple decades now and is one of the main ways that the state is spending taxpayer dollars to alleviate our literacy problems. But what we found is that is having a negligible impact. Story 4 looks at dyslexia, which I think there are just a lot of misconceptions about the disorder. And some researchers even estimate up to 1 in 5 people have dyslexia to some degree. Unfortunately, the state has not been willing to acknowledge that. And our dyslexia law showed that. And story 5, I think, is really important because, you know, the first 4 stories focus a lot on the role of phonics, and that's that part of the brain-based reading. But what we know from other research is that phonics alone is not going to solve our literacy crisis. So chapter 5 looks at what else needs to be done.
As you point out, it's not unusual to hear the comment, "Thank God for Mississippi," referring to the state, that state's usual ranking below Kentucky on all kinds of measurements. But where illiteracy is concerned, we can no longer say that?
We can, and that's because Mississippi, starting in 2013, passed a really aggressive literacy law that is based on the brain science. And in 2019, on this national benchmark test, Mississippi was the only state to show growth in fourth grade reading. And in the most recent round of testing this past spring shows now that Kentucky, which had been pretty high up and is falling, is now at the same level of literacy as Mississippi.
Courier Journal investigative reporter Mandy McClair, and you can find Mandy's 5-chapter series on illiteracy in Kentucky online at courier-journal.com. Just type illiteracy in the search bar and you'll be taken to the series. You do have to subscribe. Thanks for your work and for joining us, Mandy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
The direct connection between education and your paycheck is the focus of Bridget Blom's latest contribution to our ongoing series about public education in Kentucky.
Education and the growth of a state's economy have long been linked. In fact, states track their education rankings relative to other states, and nations routinely look to one another to see who is performing better when it comes to overall student outcomes. Vicki Phillips, Kentucky born and raised, was announced earlier this year as the new CEO of the National Center for Education and the Economy, based in Washington, D.C. In this role, she's charged with leading a group of people tasked with solving our nation's most challenging education problems. Dr. Vicki Phillips, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. I really appreciate the invitation to be on.
Vicki, you grew up in Western Kentucky, went to Western Kentucky University to become a teacher. How have your formative years shaped your approach to education and your work as a leading voice in education improvement?
So, Bridget, I grew up in Falls of Rough, Kentucky, where we often hunted for our supper, had outhouses in our backyard, and looked out for our neighbors. And there was really no expectation for me that I might do more than graduate high school, if that. Believe it or not, it was a peer when I was a junior in high school who wouldn't accept the inequities between us and made sure that where I grew up didn't dictate where I ended up. She pushed me to go to college. She worked to ensure that that became a reality. And in many ways, it was that young peer who literally changed my life. And since then, I've gone from sort of no expectations or low expectations to very high expectations. And everyone I've worked for, from the first principal when I was a teacher to being a 2-time superintendent and a state chief of education to getting to work nearly a decade at the world's largest philanthropy to more recently working as the chief education officer for National Geographic. I've had these amazing opportunities, including the one now as the CEO of the National Center on Education and Economy. But, you know, what's been so important to me is that I've never forgotten where I came from and the sense of community and caring and, you know, looking out for others and giving others an opportunity that resulted from my Kentucky roots.
You have done so many different things that you now bring to your role at the National Center on Education and the Economy. And we want to talk a little bit more about that in our time together. But first, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the time you've spent in Mayfield, Kentucky. Quite a chunk of time since the tornadoes there. What has that recovery been like? What's that personal experience been like for you? And what hope might you offer to those Eastern Kentucky listeners experiencing the aftermath of flooding?
It's been such a range of emotions witnessing firsthand what's happened in Western Kentucky last year with the tornadoes, and then seeing what's happened with the flooding in Eastern Kentucky. And my heart really goes out to both communities because the devastation is in some ways overwhelming. So many people lost their lives, and it's been really hard to see Kentucky hard hit twice in less than a year. And in Mayfield, you know, much of the rubble's now been cleared away, and there's a lot of rebuilding. And as I said, I've experienced that whole range of emotions from heartbreak at what people have endured, but also just being incredibly inspired by the grit and the determination. And it's been amazing to see what, you know, the people in this community have done for themselves, but also the fact that volunteers have come from all across the country. I mean, one example is a not-for-profit called A Soldier's Journey, who built a beautiful house for a veteran in 12 days. They brought 150 volunteers from across the country, New York to Seattle. And then there's countless other groups working alongside community members to rebuild, to provide food. The business leaders, the mayor, and the communities of faith here in particular have been among the most agile and flexible and responsive of orgs, and had in many ways so many losses themselves because they lost people and churches. You know, one of the things I've come out of this with is not only a renewed admiration and respect for the people of Kentucky and others who experience these kinds of dream events, but I've also come out with this sense of how important it is to storytell about the human toll and impact. 54% of Americans live in a place impacted by extreme weather in 2021 alone, let alone what's happening now in 2022. And I think this is an important issue that we need to keep front and center and in people's purview so that people continue to volunteer and give and share information and understand the magnitude of the human toll and think hard about what we need to do across this country to come together around what's happening.
Both of these events in Kentucky have happened near the start of school, as teachers were preparing their classrooms, students were gearing up to come back into school, and in both places, schools have been impacted physically, making it difficult for teachers to get back into the classroom and certainly making it difficult for kids to get back into a learning environment. You've placed a high priority on teaching and teacher leadership throughout your career. So, what did you see, I guess, there in Mayfield as you were watching these teachers struggle to connect with their students in such a disastrous environment? And then share with us your thoughts on what teachers need to do their best work. And as a nation, how we might respond to the worry of teacher shortages, compounded, surely, by these traumatic weather events.
Sure. You know, here in Mayfield, I saw what happens when a disaster like that hits and kids and families just need to scatter everywhere. They need to find shelter and food wherever they can. Some have loved ones they can go and stay with, others don't. And it was pretty remarkable to watch the school district here and to talk to both teachers and people that worked at Central. This school district lost every single bus they had and their bus garage, and districts from all over the state of Kentucky offered them extra buses in the meantime. So you just saw again how people rallied. But this district managed to go out and stay in touch with every single kid and to mostly bring those kids and families back into school. And a lot of that was that amazing sense of community connection that people have, where they will do whatever it takes to, you know, give kids and community members opportunity. So that was and has been and continues to be really powerful to watch educators step up to the challenge. And this has kind of been the story of my career, that I have been a lifelong teacher champion because I think there's something really magical about what happens between kids and teachers. And teachers are on the front lines. And when the going gets tough, they step up. They stepped up in COVID by standing up virtual classrooms virtually overnight. They were like healthcare workers on the front lines trying to figure out what to do. They were innovating and creating on the fly. And I think that's exactly what happens when these big disaster hits too, that teachers step up and do what they can to make sure their students are safe, well cared for, and get to continue learning. And as a leader, I believe that the job of education leaders is to honor that bond that exists between teachers and kids in classrooms, wherever classrooms may be, on whatever form they might take, and that our job is to give it all the power that we can, and that we should listen to teachers' voices, understand that they too are leaders, and, you know, put them at the table helping us design solutions that give more and more kids an opportunity. And then when you think about the teacher shortage across the country, I think first we have to be careful about how we look at and interpret that data. In some places, there's indeed a teacher shortage, and other places, not so much. So the data is very contextual. If you look at Mississippi, they have very high levels of teacher shortages, and other places, not so much. And then there are different places, you know, coming up with creative solutions. In Pennsylvania, for example, NCEE and Teach Plus are coming together and doing a teacher summit around the shortages and trying to figure out what can happen in that state specifically. So I think it's incredibly important to figure out first, what's the data here in Kentucky? And then how do you bring an array of people together, including teachers who may very well have solutions to this, to the table?
So, Vicki, as you embark on the leadership of the National Center on Education and the Economy, what do you hope to achieve there? And where might Kentucky fit into your work now with this organization at the national level and, frankly, globally?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, the National Center on Education and Economy was actually my first job out of Kentucky. So after I served my home state as a teacher and then at the state level in the CARA days, I went to work at the National Center, obviously not in the CEO role, but this is like a coming home for me. And one of the things I've always admired about the center is the fact that we scour the United States and the world to find out what the best practices are in education. We benchmark high-performing countries. We look at, you know, who's implementing various aspects incredibly well. And we bring that knowledge back to practitioners in local places, be that a state or district or even a school. And we help them think through how they can adapt, modify, go one better even on those practices to improve their outcomes. So one thing that I know we will continue to do under my leadership is maintain that level of international and U.S. benchmarking and the rigor of the knowledge that we bring to the table to help practitioners on the ground and also to help policymakers. So we work with a lot of states and policymakers across the country to think about what kind of policy reduces barriers and enables education and outcomes for kids to flourish. I think we'll also, because I've heard a lot of superintendents ask us for this, continue to work hard to translate what we know from around the world into practical application in the field so that it's easier for districts and schools to be both inspired by it and to adapt it. And obviously, because we are the National Center on Education and the Economy, in addition to thinking hard about pre-K through 12 and what systems need to change there or be redesigned, we're incredibly interested in how we help young people get a foothold on a career path and a credential that makes a difference to them lifelong.
Dr. Vicki Phillips, CEO of the National Center on Education and the Economy and a Kentuckian, thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
My pleasure.
Bridget Blom is president and CEO of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. Coming up after the break, a unique study is underway at UK into opioid use among African Americans.
This is one of the nation's first and only studies actually specifically looking at this.
The author of a book about sport fishing in Kentucky reveals his favorite spot.
The lake is full of quality black bass, but there's also striped bass. And in the tailwaters, there's really, really awesome trout fishing.
And what the man who wrote the music and lyrics for the Tony Award-winning musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch has to say about his adopted hometown of Lexington, Kentucky.
Music in this town, it's almost on that kind of level of like New Orleans. Like, it's just like the people that do it, they do it.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable and trusted energy information. Co-ops offer updated electric vehicle news and an EV calculator to help members make the change to charging. More information at togetherwesaveky.com. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
What do we know about non-medical prescription opioid use among Black Americans? The data that it takes to make informed decisions about solutions has been almost non-existent. But that's changing, as we hear from Gerald Smith and his guest in the latest in our series on racial justice and equality.
Welcome, Dr. Danielle Stevens-Watkins.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smith, for having me. It is a pleasure to be here.
So you have received a major grant from the National Institute on Drug Abuse to conduct one of the nation's first studies on non-medical prescription opioid use among African Americans. If you would share with us a little bit more about the purpose of the grant and why this particular research is significant to the state of Kentucky.
Absolutely, yes. And so we were very intentional about the title of this project, naming it Refocus, because for the last, 5 to 10 years, opioid overdose deaths and opioid use, particularly in Kentucky, has largely been seen as a rural problem only affecting white Americans. And this narrative extends certainly beyond Kentucky to a national level. And so that is the importance, is that we want science, we want government, we need policymakers and communities to refocus their attention on the Black community who are also dying from misuse of opioids and opioid-related overdose.
So how are you going about recruiting your users? And if you could tell us something about the interview process that will assist you and your team in understanding the characteristics associated with their drug abuse.
One thing that we like to rely on is data. And so recent data shows that particularly overdose deaths for opioids among Black Americans has more than doubled in recent years. And so using that data, we walk the communities in the Jefferson County and Fayette County area. We talk with community stakeholders and community leaders and inform them, this is a major problem and we need your help. We need your help in talking to folks who do misuse opioids to gain a better understanding of you know, their pattern of drug use, gain a better understanding of their experiences in treatment. And by talking with us and recruiting folks to come in and talk to us, which is a challenge, I will say, we're able to gather data that will help better culturally inform our policies, our practices, and treatment centers, and hopefully will yield our expectations that this will yield better outcomes. One particular challenge that we have with recruiting is stigma. And so, you know, drug use and mental health, and it's interesting because people are, you know, more likely to talk about mental health concerns, that they are starting to be a little less stigmatized, particularly in Black communities. But drug use still remains very stigmatized and seen in some ways very different than mental health concerns. When really, as a psychologist, right, drug use disorders do appear in the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and are considered mental health disorders. And so getting out into the community, walking the neighborhoods, hosting barbecues, talking to people and say, you know, we care. We want to know your story so they can help influence larger outcomes.
Could you say a little bit about your research team? I mean, what is their background? Because they're the ones, along with yourself, out there recruiting users.
I am very fortunate to have a extremely hardworking research team, primarily made up of women of color. And so women that identify as Black or biracial. We do have a couple of men. We do not intentionally leave the men out. We do have a couple of men on the team. And our team is also largely made up of graduate students completing their PhD in counseling psychology, or recent graduates who are now postdoctoral scholars that have completed their degree in psychology. And so I believe what makes us unique is, given our very extensive background in mental health training, we're able to connect with people in the community, you know, be able to use our counseling skills to listen, to show empathy, and to show that we genuinely care about each and every person. Although this is a research project, we believe that, we know that there is distrust in the Black community specific to research. And so we really want to shift that narrative and, you know, leverage our skills and talents to really connect with folks and not just use people for data or just use people as a research subject. We genuinely care about this problem because it is our own communities that are being affected.
So poverty, unemployment, and racial inequality are some of the most apparent factors which have historically led to overdose death rates among Black people. But what are some other factors that have led to this increase?
Yes. And so as you've highlighted, clearly there are structural factors that historically lead to drug use disorders. And, you know, you already highlighted those. Some of the other factors that lead to these overdose rates are, number one, opioids are oftentimes seen as a safe drug because they are available by prescription. And this is a complex phenomenon because oftentimes medical providers may underdose African-American patients and are hesitant to actually prescribe controlled substances with some sort of, you know, discriminatory lens at times, thinking that, oh, well, they're more likely to result in addiction. The problem there is, however, without being, you know, having that physician supervision when it comes to opioids, oftentimes individuals then locate the drugs on the street. And when you're purchasing a pill or something off the street, you have no idea if it's been adulterated and what it's been adulterated with. And so a large problem is related to just kind of discrimination in healthcare practices and leading to, in some ways, what they call unsupervised medication use. So this is very complex. And so another piece of this is oftentimes older drug users that may have used crack cocaine, now we're seeing that the cocaine supply is being contaminated with fentanyl, which is a very powerful opioid and can lead to death. In addition, right, the glorification of Percocets and other prescription opioids in hip-hop culture and rap culture tends to normalize this use, particularly among our 18 to 25-year-olds, which I will say that has been the most difficult demographic to reach. We have really had a hard time reaching those that younger demographic, and they are at an increased risk for overdose.
What can be done to ensure that prevention, intervention, and recovery services are distributed equally?
Oh, that one's also complex, right? So there are so many barriers related to drug use services, prevention, and treatment. I think one step National Institute of Health is doing right now just by funding this work. This is one of the nation's first and only studies actually specifically looking at this, is to continue to fund this type of work. Also, for treatment services to provide outreach. And so oftentimes, treatment services and service providers just kind of stay in and serve those that come to them. And so knowing there is oftentimes a disconnect between treatment providers and communities of color, bridging those connections and showing that, yes, we want you to come here. Although staff may not look like you and although other patients may not look like you, we still care about your recovery. And so building those connections.
What can the faith-based community as well as other institutions do to serve as an advocate for policies and programs to address this crisis? And you just might include in there how you can be reached, you and your research team, to assist individuals who are confronting this crisis.
We need our faith-based communities to really stress the importance of destigmatizing drug use. And so we run into wanting to talk with pastors and congregations about this problem. And knowing what we know about the statistics, oftentimes no one actually in the church or affiliated with the church will say, you know, this isn't a problem here. Well, we know otherwise. We know that it is. And so I think really emphasizing for our pastors and community leaders that it's critically important that we destigmatize drug use so people can lose that barrier to connecting with others that can help them. And we can be reached at 859-257-7888. That is our Lexington number, but we are, again, collecting data in the Louisville area and in the Lexington area.
That's Dr. Danielle Stevens-Watkins, a professor in the Department of Educational, School, and Counseling Psychology at the University of Kentucky, and a core faculty member of the Center for Health Equity Transformation, and also a faculty affiliate of the Center for Drug and Alcohol Research. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
Park my truck down at the dock. See if this cell phone can skin like a rock. You can spend your whole
Kentucky is known for a lot of things: the mountain forests of the East, bourbon, racehorses, basketball, music, literature. But there's something else embedded in Kentucky history that hasn't gotten much attention until now. We're joined by Art Lander, longtime former staff outdoors writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, and author of more than a half dozen books, including A Fishing Guide to Kentucky's Major Lakes. So it's fitting that Art and antique fishing tackle enthusiast Bill Hinkebein have pooled their knowledge and talents to publish A Brief History of Bait Casting, Bass Fishing, and the Kentucky Reel. Art Lander, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
So this is a history of sport fishing in Kentucky. Has the state always been known for excellent freshwater fishing?
Well, you know, as being the first state west of the Appalachians, and it's a state with abundant streams. You know, we have 9 major river systems, and we're the only state in the Union with water on 3 sides, the Mississippi to the west, the Ohio to the north, and the Big Sandy and its Tug Fork tributary to the east. So when these people came over the Appalachians, and they were immediately impressed by the waterways and the abundance of fish in the waterways, that sort of launched our fishing culture here in Kentucky. The focus of early settlement was in the bluegrass, which is between the Kentucky River and the Licking River drainage. And that's where these real high quality streams are that were full of 3 species of black bass and literally hundreds of other species of game fish and rough fish. And the people that came over, and they realized this immediately, and the word spread, you know, come to Kentucky where the great fishing is.
Well, in Chapter 5, you tell us that the anglers who did come to Kentucky after the Revolutionary War soon discovered that the fishing tackle and techniques that they had been using, they were familiar with, pole and line, fly fishing, those kinds of things, they didn't work well here. How come?
Well, the preferred habitat of the black bass was deep pools below riffles and areas farther out in the middle of the creeks and rivers. And a lot of times these streams had overhanging limbs, so you couldn't fly cast. And a pole and line, you could only get the line out as far as long as the pole was. They needed a reel, a multiplying bait casting reel, because for each crank of the handle, spool rotates 4 times, and so that was less inertia, and they could cast out farther into the water there. And of course, this was before artificial lures, Tom, so they were seining minnows in these tributary streams and hooking them onto their line and casting live bait, and that's where the term bait casting came from.
Okay. Well, that multiplying reel that you just described, it had actually debuted, I think, in 18th century England, but Kentuckians picked up the design and improved on it. And
right.
Could you tell us about that and where that took place?
Okay. Well, they the first Kentucky reel maker was in Paris, and we're not sure, but we think that he heard about one of those multiplying reels from England that was in central Kentucky, and that he went and inspected the reel, and that's how he got the knowledge and know-how to actually make a multiplying bait casting reel.
And these are real collector's items nowadays.
Oh, yes. I mean, you got to remember, there was only 10 individuals and families that made these reels, and they were made roughly between 1810 and 1948. And over that period of time, hundreds, perhaps thousands of these reels were made. And even though they were made to a set of specifications, they really couldn't make them all exactly the same. And they could only make like 2 or 3 a month. So they were time consuming to make, and they were expensive. Only the landed gentry and the wealthy politicians and people could afford to own them. It was not something that the average fisherman could afford.
Well, I have to ask you, Art, and you're probably not going to answer this, but are you willing to reveal your favorite fishing hole?
I've covered fishing for more than 30 or 40 years. I mean, it's so long, I can't remember. And I've been an avid fisherman my whole life. But I really and truly, I will tell you that from my long experience, Lake Cumberland and the Lake Cumberland tailwaters is probably my favorite lake. And that's because the lake is full of quality black bass, but there's also striped bass in there. And in the tailwaters, there's really, really awesome trout fishing. And in Lake Cumberland itself, there's also a big walleye population. So when you're down there bass fishing, There's no telling what you might catch.
That's great. Art Lander, co-author with William Hinkbine of A Fishing Guide to Kentucky's Major Lakes, and, by the way, father of the amazing local fiddler, Maggie Lander. Thanks for joining us, Art.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Dwayne Lundy is back with his Depth of Field series after sitting down with the composer of the music and lyrics of the Tony Award-winning Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Stephen Trask, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You're actually my first in-person interview since I started the show, so I appreciate you coming in. We've known each other for 17 years. I was a big fan of your work, in particular Hedwig. Before I got to know you, it's been a thrill to not only get to know you as a friend, but actually have an opportunity to work with you. Your story is an incredibly compelling one, but let's just start back. Young kid from Connecticut, moved to the big bad city of New York. Can you sort of take us from there?
You know, I think I knew music was my thing. I also vaguely knew I was an outsider. I didn't really connect with my piano teachers. One of them I left. And the other one fired me. She was like, "Young man, I can't teach you anymore. You're wasting my time and your mother's money."
What age is this?
Fourth or fifth grade. I didn't want to learn the stuff she wanted me to learn. And then I stopped playing in my freshman year of high school. My mother found this teacher, Ed Squalia, and he taught pop music, which I thought meant like learning "I Will Survive" and whatever was on the radio at the time. But for him, it meant learning like classics from the 40s and 50s.
Like Rosemary Clooney tracks or Roger Miller's.
Yeah, just like Ebb Tide and The Shadow of Your Smile and Misty. But also like the contemporary hits like If by Bread or Yesterday. And he would come down. I remember the first lesson, he had the flu and he showed up in a trench coat and he's coughing and his hair's all greasy. "Yeah, my dad, can I get you something to drink?" He's like, and then he holds his hand up, like showing like as far as he, like a thumb and forefinger, like 5 inches apart, and goes, "Rye." My dad poured him a big, tall glass of rye. And
that's really your introduction to the real side.
Yeah,
is.
And we went down to the basement and he smoked Pall Malls and drank his rye. And we talked about music. And then he wrote out two charts for me. And one of them was The Sound of Silence, and the other one was, it was more of a classic, and I don't remember what it was. It was just the lead and the chord written above it. And that's how I learned to play.
Right. Okay, so there you are. You're in Connecticut, learning to play. Then you fast forward 10, 15 years, you end up in New York City, as we know, a tough city to sort of make a mark in, and you end up meeting up with John Cameron Mitchell, and you guys team together to write Hedwig, which, in my opinion, is one of the most important pieces of music of the 90s, both culturally and musically. Can you give us a little bit of insight as to how that happens?
So we started becoming friends in around 1990. We met on a plane, and we kept in touch a lot. And then we kept running into each other through other friends until finally we started hanging out. One of the things was I kept trying to get him to come see my band. Finally came to see my band. Which was? Cheater. And Cheater was very like queer rock, which kind of didn't really have a place because like if you weren't going to make an overt political statement, just say she if you're going to say I love you to somebody
right.
In a song and you're, mm-hmm. I just wasn't me. Being a sort of acolyte of John Lennon, it wasn't really palatable for me or even possible for me to write stuff that was coming from a perspective other than who I was. And so John came to see my band, and it was an amazing night because the whole city of New York had shut down from a snowstorm. There was like over a foot of snow had fallen. You know, it was a very formative night for me, and then gave John a tape of some stuff that we'd recorded, and he was like, "I want to write a musical with you." And I'd been looking for someone to write a musical with. And so we started writing. He wanted me to write something based on this one story from Plato's Symposium. And I wrote Origin of Love. And so that was sort of an impetus for the piece. You know, and we started working, we're coming up with these characters, and John told me the story about his babysitter, and I suggested that he do her and make her into a drag character that just kind of like happened. He's like, I love that. And I was like, great, let's do it. And so this character started off as Helga, and we made her into Hedwig.
From the Broadway cast version of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, featuring Neil Patrick Harris and a couple of Lexingtonians, here's Origin of Love.
The last time I saw you, we just split in two. You were looking at me, I was looking at you. You had a way so familiar, I could not recognize, 'cause you had blood on your face, I had blood in my eyes. But I could swear by your expression that the pain down in your soul was the same as the one down in mine. Oh, that's the pain that cuts a straight line down through the heart. We call it love. We wrapped our arms around each other, try to shove ourselves back together. We were making love, making love. It was a cold, dark evening such a long time ago, when by the mighty hand of Job, it was a sad story how we became lonely two-legged creatures. It's the story of the origin of love. That's the origin of love.
It's an incredible opportunity that at the age that you were at, meeting the people that you met, that you were able to have such a personal experience with the things that you were going through, with your music, with a sexual orientation, with the climate of the 90s, and have the backdrop of this incredible piece that not only was great in that moment and brought good opportunities for you and John, and but would actually be such a defining piece to the course of your life. And it's actually a very fluid piece. In some ways, it's evolving and it sort of changes. And I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I do. I first of all, I know what you mean. I will say that there's a bit of luck, and there's a bit of like, I definitely had this attitude that like, you know, like this is really, really corny cliche, but like, you know, it's always like, when an opportunity knocks, will you listen? And it's like, and I was like, you know, I think opportunity is always knocking. So I had this sort of attitude, and one night I was with this band, and you know, they did a thing that was kind of like music from Big Pink, but all acoustic guitars, and they were very talented, and so I was playing with them, and one night we're at this bar, Don Hills, and our drummer didn't show up for sound check, and it was totally empty. And I'm looking around, and I was told, this is a club that hasn't found its identity yet. I remember just thinking in my head, this is my cavern club.
This is where you're going to work it out.
I'm going to figure it out here. And I just started playing. I did 50 years worth covers over a 50-year period. I even did some Ellington and mm-hmm. like some original like kind of
which all shows
jazz.
Up later in your work.
It does. Yeah. So it's all there. And so I was in, and it was a hit instantly. It was like an instant hit. All of my friends that had been meeting John, and all the that circle of people that from that snowy night, like yeah. that whole extended circle of people, they all just started hanging out there. It eventually became 50% past the fire code yeah. on any given night.
So you guys get together. You seem to garner a lot of attention very quickly, especially from some very high profile people, Yoko being one of them, David Bowie, Lou Reed. Did you know that it was going to continue to sort of grow into what it did, which was the movie to Broadway years later, winning a Tony? It's always fascinating to me whether people are present in that crossfade moment between struggle and success.
We were always on the verge of closing. When Bowie came, it was a sold out crowd, but not a single person there paid for their ticket. Like it was like, you know, we had two publicists knew how to work it. So they got celebrities to come, and they made sure that whenever the celebrities came, it was packed. You know, so we ran a long time. I remember it was just before Time Magazine did this like best rock musical written for the stage ever. The next week was the first week that we didn't lose money, but we were we'd been open for like 4 months, and our producers had just called us in to say, like, last week was our worst week. We want you to know that we are committed to keeping this show open, but we have $45 in the bank. The Time magazine thing was the change. It wasn't really the people showing up. But the moment that I felt fulfilled was when I saw Lou Reed in the audience, and I just burst into tears.
That's amazing. Fast forward, you've done score work, both film and stage. You're on the other side of this career-defining moment with Hedwig, and you find yourself in Lexington, Kentucky. What year is that?
We bought a house here in 2004.
I was really lucky. You and I met not long after that, and I was working with quite a few young, talented people.
And I stole them from you.
No, not at all. It was the best thing. It's a lovely thing. Two of those people are Matt Duncan, incredible songwriter, performer, and my musical brother, Justin Craig, who can somewhat do it all, ended up in the Hedwig Broadway version in 2014. Did you have any preconceptions coming from New York to Lexington as to what type of talent was down here?
You know, I had no conceptions and like no clue whatsoever. But as soon as I started meeting people from the music scene here, I was like, oh, this place is special. Like Duncan and Justin, for being a multi-instrumentalist is for them what it is for other people to use both legs to walk. It's just part of who they are. And that music in this town, it's almost on that kind of level of like New Orleans. Like, it's just like the people that do it, they do it. But I knew right away there's something special here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to ask, what's next? I know that you tend to sort of go into deep, almost meditative study with whatever it is that you're preparing to do next. What do we have coming up in the future?
Here's a happy thing and sad thing. Like, there were some opportunities lost in the pandemic that would have relieved a lot of the need to make money at any particular juncture. It doesn't mean I wouldn't want to make money, but there was a lot of money lost. And all I could think about was, now I don't have to take any job that anyone wants. I'll just make my, and if it makes money for me, great. And eventually I figured it probably would. I'm really into the analog synths, incorporating them with other instruments and finding that sound. For me, like if I were to say I have nothing else to do over the next year, musically, what I would be doing is composing for the synth, filming myself while I do it, and making videos.
Well, thank you so much for doing this with me. I love spending time with you.
I love spending time with you.
And taking time out of your busy schedule to come hang out, it has meant a lot. Stephen Trask, thank you so much again. You've been listening to Depth of Field, Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.